Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Emily Winicky and I am the Community Engagement Coordinator here at Syracuse University. I would like to begin, as we do with all Syracuse University events, by acknowledging with respect the Onondaga Nation, firekeepers of the Haudenosaunee, the indigenous people on whose ancestral lands Syracuse University now stands. Before I introduce this morning's speaker, I want to thank everyone for being flexible and patient with us as we transition TMR to a virtual platform. I am now honored to introduce this morning's speaker, Dr. Mike Haney. Dr. Mike Haney is Syracuse University's Vice Chancellor for Strategic Initiatives and Innovation. As Vice Chancellor, Dr. Haney leads a broad portfolio of responsibility centers and innovation initiatives, including the university's robust portfolio of entrepreneurship and innovation programs and cross-campus efforts to develop and enhance academic offerings for online and non-traditional students. Haney also oversees the university government and community engagement strategies, as well as defense and veteran-connected programs and initiatives across the institution. In 2011, Haney founded Syracuse University's Institute for Veterans and Military Families, the nation's first interdisciplinary institute created to inform and advance the policy, economic, and wellness concerns of America's veterans and families. Dr. Haney has received numerous awards for his scholarship, teaching, and community engagement, and he routinely provides counsel to private and public sector leaders on issues related to small business, innovation, and veterans. Haney completed his PhD in entrepreneurship and business strategy at the University of Colorado at Boulder, his MBA at the University of Oregon, and his undergraduate degree in political science from the University of Delaware. Before beginning his academic career at Syracuse University, Haney served for 14 years as an officer in the United States Air Force. Earlier this year, Vice Chancellor Haney was tapped by Syracuse University Chancellor Kent Severud to lead the university's COVID-19 preparedness and response. This morning, Dr. Haney will speak with us about the university's response to COVID and its fall reopening efforts. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Mike Haney.
Thank you very much, Emily. I appreciate the opportunity to be back at TMR. Reflecting a little bit, I think it's been almost 3 years since I spoke at TMR. I think my last opportunity was to co-present with my good friend B. Gonzalez about the university's community and economic development efforts. It's a very different subject today, but I do appreciate the opportunity to share with members of our community sort of the story, if you will, of Syracuse University's response to the COVID health crisis. And in I will share that this is really the first time that I've had the opportunity to tell this story in the way I'm going to tell it today. It was in preparation, it was a bit of a, I'll say, cathartic experience for me in that, reflecting all the way back to March when the university first took public action in response to COVID and all that's happened since. And that timeline is what I'm going to share today. The journey that we've been on along the way, really the first time that we've had the opportunity to step back and put a little of this story together. So I do appreciate the opportunity to share a little bit of it with you, and I hope that I will also have time to answer any questions you may have. So Emily, if you could put up the slides. So and then go to the first slide if you would, Emily. So this is the Syracuse.com headline all the way back to March 10th and 11th, and it was over this 24-hour period, March 10th and 11th, that the university made public its decision not to return Syracuse University students who were currently on spring break to our residential campus and transition the university to online learning. What is interesting is, and in the context of the larger national narrative as it relates to COVID, is these 2 days, March 10th and 11th, are widely cited today in the context of that national story, as the days that Americans really, that 24-hour period, Americans really came to understand what we were up against with regard to COVID. And let me give you a few examples as to why. At the same time, Syracuse University announced its decision to transition online. That was the same day that the number of COVID cases in the United States crossed the 1,000 case mark, and that was up tenfold from the prior week. And on that same day, only 29 Americans had died of COVID at that time. On that same day that we announced our transition to move online, the World Health Organization, which had only begun referring to the virus as COVID-19 a month earlier, declared COVID a global pandemic. On that same day, on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell just over 1,400 points and officially entered bear territory. On that same day, Capitol Hill confirmed its first case of COVID-19. On that same day, the NCAA announced it would play its basketball tournament, the NCAA tournament without fans. On that same day, the NBA suspended season after a player tested positive for COVID. On that same day is when Tom Hanks and his wife Rita posted on Instagram that they had been diagnosed with COVID-19 and were in Australia recuperating. And on that same day, that evening, President Trump gave an Oval Office address where he announced a travel ban from Europe and declared a national emergency. And this is also when Americans, by the way, started panic buying toilet paper. All of us at Syracuse University did not necessarily pay a lot of attention at the time to all of those announcements because we were very busy focusing on how to make this transition to online learning. Our immediate concern was the health, safety, and welfare of our students, of our faculty, and our staff. Understand that while many of our students were away from campus on spring break at this time, we still had over 1,000 students that were with us on campus at Syracuse University. These were international students that didn't necessarily have anywhere to go over spring break. These were some of our domestic students who, for various reasons, couldn't travel on spring break. They were still with us on campus. At the same time, we also had more than 1,000 students that were on study abroad programs when we made this decision. If you recall, the COVID situation in Europe was much worse in March than it was in the United States. And it was an imperative for us to do the work to essentially bring all of those students home. And that was a very significant challenge because you just heard me describe that on the same day that we announced this transition, the president also announced a travel ban from Europe. So we were very focused on how do we safely bring more than 1,000 students that were studying at SU abroad locations home quickly, working with parents, working with the State Department. And over the course of the next 3 weeks, we were able to bring all of our study abroad students home to the United States. Our focus then shifted to how is it that we support our faculty and our students in this new online learning environment. I will say we were fortunate in that over the course of the last 18 months or so, the university, independent of COVID, had made a strategic commitment to the online learning modality as part of the university's competitive strategy moving forward. So we had made over those 18 months significant investments in building the infrastructure required for us to introduce and grow and scale new online programs at the university. We were able to pivot that infrastructure very quickly to support the the transition to an online learning modality for our faculty, many of whom had not taught online up to that point. It certainly wasn't perfect, but I think compared to many of our peers, we were able to make that transition in terms of our academic enterprise relatively seamlessly. Fast forward to, and if you would go to the next slide, Emily. Fast forward a few weeks, and there's a lot more detail I could fill in there, but I do want to get to, ultimately the reopening of our campus in the fall. Fast forward a few weeks, and as early as April, we began focusing on the return to our campus in the fall. And, you know, one of the very clear imperatives that from Chancellor Severud, from our campus community, that was made clear that was that if we were going to reopen the university in the fall, we had to prioritize first and foremost the health, safety, and well-being of our students, our employees, and the Central New York community. And I think the smartest thing that we did within 2 weeks of the decision to transition online in March was to essentially let science guide us. We are fortunate at Syracuse University to have a very robust public health program in our Falk School. I recognized while the chancellor, as Emily said, asked me to lead this initiative, one of the life lessons I took from my time in the military is the importance of recognizing what you don't know. And there was an awful lot of public health, and there still is an awful lot about public health that I don't know. So I think the smartest thing I did in the context of these early days of focusing on how we plan and prepare Syracuse University in the context of the COVID epidemic was to bring in public health professionals from our faculty to essentially guide, direct, and inform our strategy. I remember very, very well within 4 or 5 days of being asked to lead this effort, bringing over a group of epidemiologists, faculty from our Falk School to sit with me in a conference room. And I told them, pretend I am your student, make me smart. What do we need to know? And that began a relationship that over the next few weeks became formalized into a task force, a public health task force at Syracuse University that was focused on the set of immediate concerns that the institution had with regard to supporting and safeguarding the campus community as it existed at the time in March and April. Recall, we still have more than 1,000 students on our campus, but also then turning our attention to the fall and what conditions, if you will, do we need to set now at Syracuse University in order to consider how we may reopen the institution in the fall. We were making these decisions. I think I have described to others that the complexity of this problem was more complex than any issue or challenge that I had faced in the context of my 14 years on active duty in the military, because unlike any of those situations, the decision-making context that we faced going all the way back to March and April was one where we were making decisions in the face of an inherently unknowable future. The science wasn't clear. The public policy wasn't clear. The extent to which those we serve in the context of our academic community, our students, families, staff, their position relative to reopening the institution in the fall was unclear and it was uncertain. All that said, our focus became very much grounded in this idea that reopening the institution, the necessary condition has to be that we can do it safely and that we can do it in a way that not only doesn't jeopardize the health and well-being of those who are members of our campus community, but also the health and well-being and the safety of the broader Central New York community. Emily, if you go to the next slide for me. So essentially, this set of bullets on the slide became our marching orders, if you will. We started, and again, all the way back in March and April, we started thinking about the fall with under the assumption, if you will, that we will reopen the institution. So we did not necessarily have a process that was first designed to answer the question of yes or no. We started with yes. We are going to open Syracuse University in the fall. And it was the process, if you will, was positioned to prove that assumption wrong. We would be guided by science and science first and foremost. The reopening plan at Syracuse University prioritized health and safety above all else as guided by science. So the extent to which our academic enterprise, our student experience enterprise, our facilities enterprise, et cetera, those were not the driving inputs to our reopening plan. It all started with the science and health and safety, and then we asked all of those other dimensions of our larger enterprise, the facilities infrastructure, to conform to the health and safety standard that we needed set. We needed the academic enterprise to subsequently conform to the health and safety imperatives that were identified as it relates to restarting a residential campus. An important part of this process was to listen to our community. That community, and I'm using that word very broadly, listen to our students. What did they want from Syracuse University in the context of reopening? Starting with the question, do you want to come back to campus at all in the context of this of this global health emergency? The answer to that question was very clear to us. We got an overwhelming response from students and families. Certainly not a unanimous response, but an overwhelmingly positive response with the idea and the expectation that Syracuse University would try to reopen in the fall. The sentiment that we would, it was very against the institution making a decision over the summer to not at least attempt to restart our residential campus in the fall. We did a lot of engagement with faculty and staff. We did a lot of engagement with the community at large, Zoom sessions, community meetings, meetings with landlords, great partners in both the city and Onondaga County leadership, having many, many conversations about the right way to bring students and the community together in the context of sort of the collective obligation that we have to safeguard health and well-being, and very much this last bullet, stick to the plan till we can. We have spent a ton of time We had almost 200 faculty, staff involved in various task forces and committees, to devise a reopening plan for the institution. Back to what I said earlier, that the challenge with planning and in the context of this environment is this idea of planning in the face of an inherently unknowable future. That was the challenge that we faced, because it seemed that as we work through June, July, and then even into early August, many of our best laid and most thoughtful planning exercises were made irrelevant by new science. They were made irrelevant by changes in public policy. They were made irrelevant by decisions made in Washington, D.C. or in Albany, about things like travel, for example. And I'll get to some practical examples of those in a little bit. So we also, the point is, had to learn how to be adaptable. We had a backup plan to a backup plan to a backup plan for almost every element of the reopening plan at Syracuse University, because we very quickly acknowledged that without a backup plan for all of the important dimensions of reopening the institution, again, we will likely fail. Because the environment is changing too fast, the science is changing too fast, the public response to the COVID crisis is evolving too quickly. So we had to be adaptable in the context of our own reopening plan. So next slide. So as I said, this really started with health and safety. And the first major output, if you will, of our reopening planning process was the Syracuse University SAFE plan. This was the institution's public health and safety planning guide, if you will, that would inform all of the subsequent academic planning, all of the subsequent facilities infrastructure planning, all of the policy that the university would adopt in the context of the COVID health emergency. This plan was developed by a team of public health professionals, epidemiologists from our Falk School, medical professionals, input from all of the relevant units across the university. I think the total was somewhere upwards of 250 recommendations. And this plan, if anyone would like to see it, is posted publicly and has been most of the summer on the Syracuse University fall reopening website. Essentially 200 plus recommendations with regard to how we transform almost everything we do at Syracuse University to be responsive to the COVID situation on our campus. Recommendations that, to give you some examples, I guess, it was out of this process that the recommendation was made to accelerate our academic semester, to start a week earlier and finish our semester at fall break. We're finishing our semester at fall break for a very specific public health reason. The risk associated with sending students away from our campus for fall break and then bringing them back is too great. So it was from this public health plan, this exercise, that the recommendation for the accelerated semester was drawn. The testing and surveillance protocols that we have in place now, defined as a context of this exercise, and I'll talk about those in a little bit. But this was a very collaborative effort that extended outside the walls of our campus. It extended to the New York State Department of Health. It extended in very close partnership with the Onondaga County Department of Health, with the health commissioner, Dr. Gupta, and her team, a tremendous partnership with Upstate. And I'll talk in more detail about that partnership in a second. Also with ESF and Lemoyne, you know, Syracuse University and ESF are essentially joined at the hip. Their students are on our campus. Our students are on their campus. Their students use many of our facilities. They are in our classrooms because we do a fair amount of teaching of ESF students in the liberal arts core of their curriculum. Much of that is taught by Syracuse University. So this entire process proceeded in partnership with ESF. We even put an ESF team member on the task force that authored the SU Safe plan, and also with Lemoyne, because we acknowledge that there are many Lemoyne students that actually live in the off-campus neighborhoods adjacent to Syracuse University. So we wanted to move forward with regard to the protocols, the policies, et cetera, that we would put in place to keep our campus safe in partnership with Lemoyne, knowing that, again, the virus doesn't see the boundaries of our campus walls. And the back and forth and the exchange between SU students, ESF students, Lemoyne students, they are all, from the perspective of the virus, part of the same system. So we needed and wanted and invited Lemoyne to be part of our process as well. And then certainly the city of Syracuse. Next slide. In June and August really became June through August really became focused on the implementation of that Syracuse Safe plan. You know, the everything from the physical transformation of our campus, for example, going through every single building on this campus and installing signage, social distance signage, reworking how the entrance and egress from those buildings is designed, so to avoid bottlenecks and congestion, that certain doors for entry, certain other doors for exit, reconfiguring all of our public spaces, essentially re-engineering them so that we have socially distant seating in every public venue on our campus, reworking air handling systems. So for example, remodeling many of our air handling systems in our buildings to install something called MERV 13 filters in all of our air handling systems. That level of filtration actually cleans the air of particles down to the size of what the COVID virus is. Focusing on small spaces such as restrooms and putting capacity limits on those, on those small spaces where you don't have a lot of air movement, and then certainly classrooms. Classrooms were a huge focus. We recognize that even if we do come back in the fall, we could not come back in the fall in a traditional way as it relates to our learning. We would have to implement some kind of hybrid residential model where in many cases we wouldn't have in a classroom at any given time the normal number of students. So the idea of creating an academic experience where maybe you have 50 students enrolled in a given section of a given course, but at any given time only 25 of those students are in the classroom at the same time, and the other 25 are beaming into the classroom from some other location in order to reduce physical density in those classrooms. Well, that presented a real challenge for us because, close to 50% of our classrooms didn't necessarily have, at the start of the summer, the capability, the technological capability to support that kind of model. So we had to work over the summer to essentially install new technology in hundreds of our classrooms on campus to support the ability for students to beam in, if you will, from remote locations to those classrooms. So in short, the physical transformation of this campus, was remarkable. The amount of work that was done over the summer, you know, to include installing, you know, 21 tents around our campus that are up permanently, that, for example, that are being used right now as outdoor classrooms. We recognize that another big piece of this puzzle, if you will, really related to health promotion and education. At the end of the day, we recognize that we could put in a very robust set of protocols, technologies, testing infrastructure, et cetera. But at the end of the, it really was about behavior, and the extent to which we would be successful or not really hinged on not just students. Everybody focuses on students, but faculty and staff as well, educating them on the behaviors that will support mitigating instances of virus on our campus if we were to return to a residential community. So we spent made a significant investment over the summer in really building out health promotion campaigns, health education campaigns, you know, simple things like signs that, you know, as you see in the image on this slide, we have more than 11,000 health promotion signs right now installed across the campus, not just signs like you see there, but inside buildings, you know, outside every elevator, for example, the do's and don'ts of riding an elevator, directional signage inside buildings, again, designed to reduce congestion and lanes of travel through buildings. A lot of time communicating with students over the summer related to health promotion. We made some decisions driven by health and safety that were important from the context of understanding the expectations. If you were to return to our campus in the fall, wearing a mask is one. You are not permitted to be on the Syracuse University campus this fall without a mask, period. Walking across campus, you know, in a building, you know, the only instance where not wearing a mask is okay is if you're a faculty member, et cetera, in your office and the door is closed as you see me right now. But if you see me or anybody else on this campus, to include visitors and contractors, you have to wear a mask on the campus. And we had to educate folks as to, because that is not necessarily a requirement of the CDC or New York State. You know, the CDC and New York State provide an alternative to a mask, and that alternative to a mask is a social distance. On our campus, we've taken that social distance off the table. So even if you are able to be beyond 6 feet of an individual, you're still required to wear a mask on our campus. And it took some education and some learning to help our community understand that. We made it part of a pledge that all students had to sign upon agreeing to return to campus. That was one of several elements of this stay safe pledge that all of our students took before coming back. Virus surveillance and testing, I'm going to talk about that in more detail in a second, because I would argue that the surveillance and testing regimen that is in place and happening at Syracuse University is probably, if not the most robust in all of higher education in the nation, it's got to be pretty close. Communication and community engagement, I'm going to come back to those in the interest of time. I'll go on to the next slide. And this is just to give you a sense, and this is just a snapshot of the preparation that happened over the summer with regard to, you know, some of what we acquired, what we installed, what we purchased to prepare to open in the fall. But it is it was a remarkable logistical exercise just to prepare ourselves for August 2nd, which is when we welcomed the first group of students back to our campus. Next slide. So I want to talk about the reopening and the return of students to campus. And I think, you've seen many, many articles in the media about failures at colleges and universities as it relates to COVID. And I think one of the themes as it relates to many of those failures was not enough work was done to what I, you know, my saying is start low, stay low. The idea of beginning the academic semester with a very low to zero prevalence of COVID on your campus. We recognized early on that that was going to be critical for us. And I'll in a subsequent slide share with you sort of how we enacted a strategy to start low and stay low. But at the end of the day, what will keep us here or not is testing. And that start low, stay low strategy combined with a significant amount of ongoing testing and then quick action to track and isolate the virus on our campus is what's going to make the difference between whether or not we make it to November and fall break or not. Next slide. So to this point of talk of start low, stay low. One of the things that we implemented at Syracuse University that unfortunately many of our peer institutions did not mandate and did not require was a pre-arrival COVID test for our entire student population. So we made it a condition upon return to Syracuse University that every single one of our students would have to demonstrate a negative COVID test within 10 days of returning to campus to the university. You know, what you see in this image is to support our students, recognizing that we bring students from all over the country and in many of those states where COVID has spiked in the period that was around when we were bringing students back. Access to testing could be a challenge, so we engaged a private sector vendor called Let's Get Checked that had an FDA-approved at-home test kit and made that FDA-approved at-home test kit available to all of our students. It was a great system for us because the Let's Get Checked, essentially as they completed tests, would inform both the student and the university of the result. So in advance of all of our students coming back, they had to either through this system or in their own community get tested, provide that result to the university, and be cleared to return. You know, I will share with this group that we intercepted many, many asymptomatic, positive but asymptomatic students prior to their return to campus through this process. And we, when I say intercepted, when we identified a positive result, that student was not cleared to return to Syracuse University, stayed at home wherever they were until they cleared the virus and then had a physician's approval to return to campus. So this is another way of saying, we shortcut what would have been many, many positive cases returning to our campus through this program. It was significantly costly to the university to do this, but we think it made a ton of sense. You know, and the other piece, and I'll just hit very, very quickly, we also took proactive steps beyond what the state required to ensure that students traveling from travel advisory states or hot states returning to the university complied with New York State's quarantine requirement. We supported that quarantine requirement for our first year students on campus, quarantined them in dorms for our first year freshmen, but we required that all above and beyond what New York State was asking, we required all of our students that were coming from hot states to certify to the institution in writing that they complied with the 14-day quarantine requirement before they returned to the university. Next slide. in spite of the fact that we tested them before they arrived, we also tested them when they arrived. This image is an actual photo of a student returning to campus. Every student had to go through a testing station before they were allowed to move into their on-campus housing or into the off-campus neighborhoods. Just between August 17th and 24th, we tested more than 20,000 students via this pooled saliva method. So this is our partnership with Upstate. Upstate Medical University actually is our testing laboratory for our saliva sampling on our campus. But again, in spite of the fact that we tested them before they arrived, we tested them again when they arrived. Start low, stay low. Next slide. Then we tested them again. So as we're having this conversation, so we tested the entire student population when they arrived, again, between August 17th and 24th. We are now in our second round of testing the entire student population. So beginning the day after the Labor Day holiday, Tuesday, September 8th, extending through today, essentially, we are collecting samples from every single student, upwards of 17,000 students on our campus, and doing a second round of testing of the entire student population. Again, using the pooled saliva method, which I don't think I have time to explain, but I can certainly explain in more detail if someone is interested. Next slide. We have also stood up the ability to do diagnostic testing in-house. So our health center, the Barnes Center, has the ability to do 30-minute rapid COVID testing, diagnostic testing. We have three different external laboratory backups if we ever run out of tests, so that we can essentially do that diagnostic testing quickly on campus. We have the same capability as a duplicate, if you will, set up for Syracuse University Athletics. Again, in-house capability to do rapid COVID testing on campus. Next slide. Test, track, isolate. This is what's going to keep us here or not. We talked about the post-arrival saliva testing, the fact that we're testing now the entire student population a second time after we get through this second round of all student testing. We will move to random sampling of students through this pooled saliva method, somewhere between 5,000 and 7,000 tests of students across campus will be done every month moving forward. The way this process works is it's a saliva swab that is essentially we test for the presence of the COVID RNA in saliva. If that test comes back positive, those students are then diagnostically tested a second time to confirm the presence or absence of COVID disease. And we do all of this in coordination with the Onondaga County Department of Health. So big piece of our surveillance is this ongoing mass pool testing. Next slide. Second dimension of our surveillance is our wastewater testing. And again, one of I think really only a few universities in the country that are taking advantage of this method. The COVID virus sheds in human feces, and we are using wastewater surveillance in the same way that they used to use wastewater surveillance to detect polio. We are sampling the wastewater coming from every single one of our dormitories, as well as our athletic buildings and off-campus neighborhoods, for the presence of the SARS RNA in the wastewater. We had a public example of this program that many of you are probably familiar with from the news, when we detected the SARS virus in the wastewater coming from Ernie Davis Hall. We asked all the students in Ernie Davis Hall to quarantine for 24 hours while we tested every student in that building. We released those students from quarantine because those tests came back without finding new active cases. As it turns out, what we believe to be the source of, of that positive hit in Ernie Davis were two students in the dorm who were recently recovered from the COVID disease, and they were still shedding, but while they were not infectious, they were still shedding virus, and that was the hit. But I think this was a good example. From the time we detected the COVID virus in the wastewater, within 90 minutes, we had a testing team in that building. Within 90 minutes, we had texted every student who lives in that building, alerting them to return to their dorm and to look in their email, because we had sent each one of those students an email that explained to them what's going on, what we had found, and asked them to return to the dorm. The students were wonderful. They were great. They returned. We tested. We determined no risk. And within 24 hours, the students were out of quarantine. Next slide. We also have stood up, in partnership with the county, our own in-house contact tracing team. So we have hired and trained students as contact tracers. They work directly with the Onondaga County contact tracing team to do all of the contact tracing, the interviews, coordinate the quarantine and isolation process on our campus. And we, importantly, we also do this in partnership with ESF. So these teams are integrated with the teams at ESF, because the big lesson learned for us at the end of the day is that what makes all the difference in the world is how quickly, from a positive result, we're able to identify close contacts and get those close contacts, if you will, out of the larger population and into quarantine. Many of the most recent positive cases that we've had on our campus, in fact, almost all, are students who were identified as close contacts. At the time they were identified as close contacts, they tested negative, but have essentially turned positive or subsequently tested positive while they're in quarantine. And that's exactly how it should work, because those individuals, when you know they were exposed, we suspected they were exposed, they were not yet, quote, positive, but into quarantine and then subsequently turned positive. That means they are not exposing others to the virus during the period that they are infected. Next slide. I'm getting a little text that I'm too slow. I gotta move to the end. So this is really my last slide, and I'm leaving you with sort of the big questions that we face as an institution and as a community, and probably the two most common questions that I get when I talk about this issue, both on campus and off campus, and that is, you know, what factors will inform sort of the ongoing assessment of risk at the institution? And it's really the three things I have listed here. What we're tracking relentlessly and every day is the prevalence of, see, they're really trying to get me to stop. They just cut me off and went to the closing slide. What we're tracking relentlessly every day is the prevalence of virus on our campus. Number of cases, number of close contacts. Importantly, the spread. And what I mean by the spread, where our public health folks get nervous are the instances of a positive case where we don't know where it came from. I can say right now, with every positive case that we have on our campus, we know exactly where it came from. We were able and have been able to contact trace those cases and understand the chain of transmission that resulted in that particular case. That's a good thing, because that gives us the information we need to isolate that chain of transmission from the larger population. And then the last thing, illness. And this is a clinical illness, if you will, the extent to which we have instances where members of our campus community are ill to the point where they have to be hospitalized, and or short of that, we have to provide that clinical care. The extent to which that capacity becomes overwhelmed is one of the things that we're monitoring closely. you know, all of this brings us to the second question is, you know, what are those metrics that will inform the decision to close or to pause? It's all about capacity. It's when our capacity to test and trace becomes overwhelmed. It's when our capacity to quarantine and isolate students, as we're having this conversation, I think we right now have 91 students in quarantine. At some point, we may face a situation where we have more students in quarantine than we have capacity to quarantine, because it's quarantine and the requirement to quarantine a student as a is a or any individual, it's very specific with regard to the room, a non-shared bathroom, et cetera. If we run out of that capacity, we face a difficult decision. And again, as I said earlier, the capacity for clinical care. So, you know, I think to bring this all together, we are cautiously optimistic. You know, I think as an institution and a community, we've done a good job to date to set the conditions for the institution to make it through a residential semester. You know, I do want to say a word about our students. They're with every week that passes, I have the opportunity to say I told you so, if you will, in a way that I hope is still humble, because many people sort of wrote off our students from the very beginning. They you know, saying things like they don't have the capacity to behave in the way you need them to behave. I would argue that our students have elevated to this point in the semester to the situation that they face. They understand what is at stake, and they have actually, with a bump in the road here or there, they've actually made us all very proud compared to the things we see on the news every night happening at many other institutions around the country. So with that, if I have any time left, I will stop and take any questions that anybody has.
Great. Thanks, Mike. So again, please use the chat function to type out your questions, and then I will be asking, reading them, just to reduce the amount of noise that's happening. So the first question we have, how much do you estimate this initiative has added to costs, and where did you see savings, if any?
So what's my best way to answer this? The cost of reopening the institution has been enormous. And you know, one of our faculty epidemiologists that I was with the other day, it's, you know, and he was sharing with me some conversations that he's had with some of his peers at other institutions, and one of the things that he made a point to highlight to me is that very different from many of his peers, there has not been a single thing that our public health professionals have asked of the university that the university hasn't provided. You know, the pre-arrival testing alone was an expense to the university that exceeded $2 million. That's the same reason why many other institutions chose not to do pre-arrival testing. But that's also why many of those same institutions are in the predicament that they're in right now. We have made no trade-offs at this institution, financial trade-offs, when it comes to health and safety. But the consequence of that will be a significant financial burden to the institution moving forward. Certainly there are some, and I'm choosing my words carefully a little bit, because I am not the CFO. And in a way, it is a testament to the fact that I have not had to, in the context of my role, worry about the financial piece of this, because the institution has said yes to everything that we've asked them to do with regard to the level of testing, the wastewater testing. That comes at a real cost to the institution, but we also recognize it's the right ethical thing to do beyond just the health and safety, if we're going to ask faculty, staff, and students to resume residential campus life, it is the obligation of the institution to keep them safe. So we have not spared any expense as it relates to that. Certainly there have been savings. You know, we're not traveling, for example. Well, there's a savings. I in the context of my normal role, probably spent, you know, upwards of 100 nights a year in hotels around, you know, whether it's running programs or fundraising, et cetera. I have not traveled. I've not been on an airplane since late February. And that's true of many of my colleagues, peers. We're not holding events, ceremonies, you know, so certainly there's some savings, but like many other institutions around the country, you know, the decision to reopen comes at a significant cost to the institution.
All right. So it seems like we have time for maybe two more questions. One being, if a student travels to a hot state, will they be required to quarantine for 14 days? And what about parents who want to come visit their students?
So the answer to that question is yes and no. We are enforcing, as we should, you know, and we have to remind folks that 14-day quarantine is not a Syracuse University policy. That is that's the law of New York State. That's the law of the land. So if a student is, or anybody is traveling to Syracuse University from a hot state, they are required to comply with New York State law. And we make that very, very clear. There are exceptions. But those exceptions are not exceptions granted by Syracuse University. So there are, for example, in the New York State travel advisory directive, the executive order signed by the governor, there are exceptions for, quote, essential personnel. Those are very specific exceptions that require a different process. So if you qualify under one of those exceptions, as essential, you still have to be tested within 24 hours and then go into what I describe as a modified 7-day quarantine. But from the perspective of the university, we are directing everyone associated with our community that they must comply with New York State law as it relates to the travel advisory. We are also highly discouraging parents, whether they come from hot states or not, from visiting their students on campus. We have restricted travel for faculty, staff, and students. Our public health experts identify visitors to our campus as one of the most significant threats to our testing and surveillance bubble, if you will. Instances of the virus being introduced to our campus community from the outside, and therefore we are severely restricting visitors to campus and discouraging parents from visiting students.
All right, you just have one more question, have any faculty and staff tested positive? And is there any indication of that came from students or community? Perhaps you can talk about the dashboard.
Sure, we have made a commitment to be very transparent with regard to a COVID situation on campus. The university updates three times a week a COVID dashboard that is available publicly on the university's fall reopening website. It tracks very specifically cases among students, cases among faculty and staff, and reports those numbers updated three times a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday by 5 o'clock. We have had over the entire summer, we have had one employee case, no zero faculty cases, one staff member case. That one staff member case, it was not an instance of, this was back in it actually towards the beginning of August. It was not an instance of that staff member actually being infected here on campus. That staff member actually had not been on campus for multiple weeks when they became infected. So it was not an example of, again, an infection that or an exposure, I guess is the right word, that happened in a classroom or in a building here on campus. It happened actually away from campus, but it just so happened that person was connected with Syracuse University, so we reported it. But we continue to report zero new employee cases, faculty or staff.
Great, thank you. All right, so Mike, we've got a question from the Post Standard. Is SU taking any disciplinary actions against students who traveled over Labor Day holiday and brought virus back to the campus?
Make sure I unmute myself. So we have shared publicly, you may have seen a note from that I sent out yesterday to the campus community. And there was a separate note that I believe came from some of my student affairs colleagues directly from students, highlighting the fact that the recent uptick in cases that we have seen on campus as a consequence of then digging into those cases, doing the investigations, et cetera, it's clear that I think we're at maybe 23 or so active cases on campus. It's clear that those 23 or so active cases that we're dealing with right now, they actually have their origins in a very small number of students who, it turns out, traveled over the Labor Day holiday and brought the virus back to our campus. It's a great case study in the fragility of the situation here. What has happened is we were able to, that it was not a coincidence that we started our second round of testing all students on the 8th of September. We very purposefully planned that second round of all student testing for immediately following the Labor Day holiday, fearing, if you will, exactly the situation that we're in now. What is fortunate is that because we were able to identify what started with a very small number of positive cases quickly, we were able to also quickly quarantine all the close contacts of those individuals. Most of the cases that we're reporting today are cases among individuals who are already in quarantine when they turn positive, sort of as I indicated during my presentation. I recognize that I have not answered your question yet. Here's where this gets challenging. We have to be very, very careful not to criminalize the contact tracing process. Contact tracing is what will save us, and honesty and being forthcoming in contact tracing matters tremendously. I don't necessarily anticipate a formal disciplinary process as a consequence of what we learn ever stemming from what we learn from contact tracing. That said, we are going to continue to reinforce what we need to count on here is our students to hold each other accountable. That ultimately is what it's going to take, because I hope that this example of the last few days maybe furthers that end. Traveling outside our bubble is high risk. We had just a few folks do it, bring the virus back to our campus, and now we have more active cases on our campus than we've had since we've opened as a consequence of that choice. And while it is important that we, as I said, do not criminalize the contact tracing process, I do hope that this serves as an example such that students can hold each other accountable and have conversations about what it means. The other piece of this is understand that there are many people in quarantine right now who did the right thing, who didn't travel, et cetera, but they happened to be exposed to somebody who did. And as a consequence, those folks are now in a 14-day quarantine. I think this is a good opportunity for students to have conversations with their roommates, their housemates, et cetera, about being accountable to each other. Because even if you do the right thing, if the person you live with doesn't, you may end up shouldering a cost as a consequence of that wrong choice that someone else made.
All right. So just, there's a kind of a follow-up question. Is there anything specifically that the university will be doing to respond to the recent spike? Anything you want to add specifically to that?
Yeah, so we're very aggressively right now, you know, essentially 24 hours a day, working through this second round of testing all students. We're going to do some enhanced testing in certain dorms where these students may have been associated with, to include even retesting again students who may have been tested earlier in the week as part of the second round of testing the entire student population. It's also likely that we will increase and bolster the existing plan that we have around random surveillance testing moving forward. You know, in this presentation, I talked about the existing plan being somewhere between 3 to 7,000 random tests a month. We may increase that number moving forward, because this can get out of, you know, I saw this morning that SUNY Oneida is now up close to 700 cases that they've identified. This can get out of control very, very quickly. You know, there is this sort of multiplier effect of, you know, for every one positive case, you may end up with 3 to 5 folks in quarantine and half of that number turning positive. So we want to shortcut every possible case we can, catch it fast, and move those individuals into isolation housing, move their close contacts into quarantine housing. That's how this has got to proceed moving forward if we're going to, you know, and now it, you know, I didn't talk about during the presentation, but the governor's executive order gives me now a ready answer to a question I get all the time, which is, you know, what will be the threshold of infection on campus where you would potentially shut down? That was a legitimate question until about 10 days ago, when the governor established that threshold at 100 cases within a 2-week period. You know, so I think we all now have a very clear definition of what it will take for us to remain a residential campus. And that number of 100 can, when you're dealing with, you know, and importantly, it's not just students. It is 100 cases among the entire campus community, which includes faculty and staff. For us, that's a population that approaches 30,000. You know, so 100 among a population of 30,000 is not a very big number. That can sneak up on you pretty fast. So I think it's in our collective interest to increase our surveillance, increase the vigilance, if you will, you know, on campus, such that we don't come anywhere close to that number.
All right, thanks, Mike. We have one more question, time for one more question from Syracuse.com. What is the quarantine capacity on campus and how many rooms are available?
So we're fortunate that at any given time, we have a standing block of rooms that we've reserved in the Sheraton for quarantine that is 100. However, we are fortunate that Syracuse University owns the Sheraton on campus, that it is run by the Sheraton under a contractual agreement that we have with the Marriott Corporation. The point of this is we have the ability to flex, if you will, our standing block of 100 to ultimately what could be the full capacity of the Sheraton, which I think is approaching 300 rooms. We have also put in place terms and condition agreements, if you will, with several other local hotels. If in fact we would have to flex or expand our quarantine requirement beyond what we can accommodate at the Sheraton. Our isolation housing, we're using the requirement for isolation the specifications, if you will, are actually a little easier to accommodate in dormitories than quarantine. Quarantine, again, requires a non-shared bathroom typically. Students who are isolated because they're COVID positive can actually share a bathroom. They can, everyone in that isolation facility is confirmed COVID positive, so they can share a bathroom, et cetera. So we're using South Campus dormitories for isolation, Sky Hall 1, and if needed, Sky Hall 3. So our isolated students, our COVID positive students are in South Campus housing, and we have plenty of capacity over there. Put it this way, if we even approach the capacity constraint we have on isolation housing, by definition, it likely means we have also exceeded the governor's threshold for new COVID cases. The quarantine is actually more tricky for us than isolation, because for every positive case, you can have anywhere from one or two to 10. One of our sororities right now is a good example of that. We have two women who in a given sorority house that tested positive, but those two positive cases resulted in upwards of 20 students being quarantined. So the quarantine number is another one that can sneak up on you pretty quickly.
All right. Thank you so much, Mike. And I know you have to go, so I'm going to cut off the questions here. So thank you everyone for coming and listening. We will be sharing this. Thank you very much, Dr. Haney.
Yep. Thanks much. See you guys.